Now, I set this interview up either last Monday or last Tuesday, and I cannot wait to have a chat with Mark Malone, because Mark is an NGO, an organization that are doing their best to stop hate for profit. Mark, good morning and welcome to the program.
Tommy, how are you doing? You well?
Mark, I have for a long time, and it's a hobby horse of mine and a drum I have been beating for many years, and I am at a loss as to, and I'm not going to single out Facebook, even though you have in your press release, but I will do a catch-all. Facebook, Twitter, any of the social media platforms you want to listen to, some of the bile and hate and absolute unbelievable crap that people put up on that beggars belief. But the bit that I can't figure out is why people who do this don't realize, number one, that they're quite clearly breaking the law, but number two, that they are liable to prosecution under the Defamation Act.
Yeah, well, just to give a bit of background to for your listeners there, Donny, I'm communications officer with COLOV, which is the Association of Returned Development Workers and Volunteers, and so a lot of our work is around, I guess, international development, social justice, equality, and we would work with people who kind of return from international development work, so they can stay engaged, I guess, with kind of movements for change and actions for change in the world generally, and particularly in Ireland. And we kind of recently, I mean, like yourself, like obviously we're quite cognizant of the types of behaviors facilitated on platforms like Facebook, Twitter, Google, YouTube. And what we have recently decided to do was to support the call that came from and originated, I guess, in the US, the Stop Hate for Profit campaign. And that arose, I guess, simultaneously with the emergence of the re-emergence, perhaps, of activity around Black Lives Matter. Looking at the role, I guess, of tech companies in terms of the types of behaviors that are facilitated, but also the absence, I guess, of accountability from those kind of organizations. And so, whilst this campaign itself targets, I guess, the target is Facebook particularly. I totally hear what you're saying in terms of the role that different corporations such as YouTube and Twitter have kind of played. There's obviously other kind of platforms and more kind of nefarious tech spaces like Gab and BitChute, for example, that are very much set up to facilitate, I guess, kind of reactionary far-right kind of hate organizing, whether that's manifested through kind of homophobia, anti-Semitism, racism, anti-feminism, kind of range of kind of activities that are related to kind of, quite strong reactionary thought. And the different platforms have had kind of different kind of responses. So, for example, YouTube has recently started to take, seems to have taken it a bit more seriously, some of the types of behaviors and the pathways of radicalizing that are happening on their platforms. We've seen Twitter recently mark, for example, President Trump's in the US, some of his tweets as kind of essentially fake news, as lies, as disingenuous. Whereas Facebook has been very reluctant, I guess, to engage the idea that they have any accountability for the types of behavior that happen on their sites.
Mark, before you go on, I'm just seeing as you mentioned and singled out Facebook and Twitter there. Now, I know, yes, because I was actually watching that on the day it happened, or following it, I suppose is the correct way to put it, when Twitter, I think they disabled Trump for a day or something like that, or a couple of hours. Is the bottom line here, Mark, that it doesn't matter what you and I say about this, or any organisation at the coalface that's trying to deal with this, that the almighty dollar and the power of capitalism is what's going to win out here, and what is winning out here?
I mean, I think there's a definite, like, yeah, as you say, right, the primary motivation force for the existence of these companies is the accumulation of wealth and profit. They're, you know, Facebook currently have, I think, close to 2 billion users. They are available in pretty much every country and have only been around, you know, less than 15 years, really, I think, you know. So has amassed a tremendous amount of wealth and alongside that, tremendous amount of power. They suck in a tremendous amount of advertising revenue. And so, you know, and there are previous models, I guess, of companies that have kind of quite nefarious impacts on society, whether that be the tobacco industry, whether that be looking at kind of fossil fuel extraction at the moment and its relationship to climate change. And, you know, certain sectors and certain organizations have long spent time kind of resisting changes, even though it was very clear the evidence of the very negative kind of social and individual impacts that they have in society. I think, like, I wouldn't be so glim in the sense that these organizations haven't been around that long. And they trade so much, they trade significantly on their brand. And the damaging of branding does have an impact. So it's quite clear that Facebook's reactions have nothing to do so far to date to do with the actual impact that they're and a sense of accountability for the impact that their product is having in different societies. So, for example, Facebook kind of admitted its role in the genocide against a Muslim minority in Myanmar in 2018. Yet it still hasn't taken meaningful action, you know, once around the role that, you know, for example, monitoring content on its site. The steps that Facebook has kind of taken have always been to firewall itself against having to take any kind of accountability or meaningful kind of action. So it started by saying, first of all, you know, they were growing very quickly. And because of the size of the organization, the amount of users that they were unable to monitor and respond quickly to what was happening on the site, essentially saying that they were too powerful and too big, really, too sprawling for them themselves to be accountable or to take responsibility for what happens. And that, if you pause to think about that, that's kind of insane to say that the product that we're creating, we know that it creates harm and we know that it has kind of, you know, very negative kind of social impacts, but it's too big for us to do anything about it or take responsibility for that. Yet at the same time, still accumulate, still expand, and still whatever. So I don't think that's plausible. Facebook's next step, I guess, once you had kind of, you know, civil society organizations, people generally, and at a certain point, nation states and governments kind of saying, look, something has to happen here. Facebook changed tack. And what they then said was, well, actually, what we want is nation states and governments to play a role in regulating us. And it's a very clever move because in one hand, what it suggests is that, well, we're open to regulation and accountability. But on another hand, what that does is, like, you have an organization that is spread across most countries in the world, yet wants to come up with a framework that pushes back that responsibility onto nation states and governments who are never going to find kind of common agreement around the particulars of how that might manifest within borders. And that pushes that game out for multiple numbers of years, again, while Facebook and Mark Zuckerberg kind of accumulate more wealth and power. However, that seems to be, I mean, there definitely seems to be a tidal shift in terms of a recognition, I guess, of what's happening at some of these platforms and also an understanding of the type of games that are being played.
But sorry, Mark, for interrupting you, but it never ceases to amaze me. And I think, now I'm open to correction on this, I'll actually have to stop and think, but I don't think that there's a day goes by that somebody sees something or reads something on Facebook and they take it as the gospel. It must be true, it was on Facebook. I mean, do people actually stop and think about this at all?
I mean, I think there's definitely a question around, like, one of the courses that we run is around kind of communication ethics and critical kind of literacy, you know, so it's like enabling people to skill themselves so they're able to make, you know, quality calls on kind of where this information is coming from.
Yeah, it's what we call in this business media literacy that you...
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. And so what we see within the algorithms of the platforms, and these are essentially code that has been designed by human beings, but they're kind of priority codes, so they're not open to examination by, you know, you, me, the general public, or by, you know, governments, by any other organizations. They're, you know, we can't actually see how these codes work. But essentially what they demonstrate, and certainly has been shown on YouTube, is that they provide ever more radicalizing kind of content. They're based on eliciting kind of short-term emotional responses, whether that be particularly emotional responses around kind of anger, frustration. And so the algorithms kind of reward those types of behaviors. And so there's, you know, whilst we can look at the question of like individual literacies and individual kind of responses, once you have these types of behaviors kind of multiplied over, you know, scales of like millions, and you kind of see that what that's around is kind of, you know, trying to deliver content, whether that be kind of videos, whether that be articles. And then you have nefarious actors. You know, so we've kind of seen, for example, the relationship with Cambridge Analytica back in 2016, where massive amounts of money are used to kind of game and to utilize the actual, the infrastructure and codes of the technological companies, to try and game and to move conversations towards, you know, support for white supremacy, anti-Semitism, violent conspiracies, Holocaust denialism, vaccine misinformation more recently, and climate denialism, you know, so that, you know, arguing that climate change, for example, doesn't exist. And we've seen the tremendous amounts of false information provided around the COVID-19 pandemic, to the extent, like, it's, you know, it's different here in some ways. There's quite a small number of kind of, you know, quite vocal kind of conspiracy theorists in Ireland, but they don't have tremendous kind of traction. But what we're seeing in the US, questions of around the sort of efficacy of masks aren't a conversation around medical science. They're actually polarized political questions where there's a correlation between now Republicans in the US sense who refuse to wear masks. You know, Trump supporters who refuse to wear a mask, you see the question of liberty and this of how disease transfers. You know. So these are things that these platforms have a tremendous stake in and have a tremendous kind of impact in. Yet what we are seeing is, and I guess what the calls for the postponing of advertising funds the organization in an attempt to kind of wield, I guess, some level of power and push around the brand, is to demand kind of accountability within the organizations. And there's the campaign itself has some quite specific kind of demands that, for example, within Facebook, that there be permanent civil rights infrastructure at a high-level executive nature, where people from communities that are most affected by the sort of hate speech that we kind of see, the online organizing, the sort of radicalization processes, that they have voices, strong voices at the table. Also then that there can be kind of independent audits of the type of activity that's happening on Facebook's platforms, because there's no transparency there really at all. And essentially there's no real rationale why people should trust Facebook and what they're at. For example, we know that Facebook in Ireland were handed a very significant briefing document back in 2018. And when I say Facebook was handed, Mark Zuckerberg himself was handed in Dublin a briefing document looking at the role of Facebook in terms of facilitating hate organizing in Ireland. That was handed to him by leader of the Green Party, Eamon Ryan. And it's our understanding that Facebook have taken no action or tried to reach out, I guess, to the authors of that report. So it's hard to see, you know, they can't, there's no plausible deniability of the organization for them to say, well, we're not really sure what's going on. We know that Facebook can see everything that happens on the platform, and that with enough kind of resources and effort, that actually meaningful action can be taken place, you know. Another problem that we have is Facebook's kind of refusal to kind of remove both public and private groups that are involved in such things as white supremacy, anti-Semitism, homophobia, you know, that vaccine misinformation stuff and climate change denial. So there's demands there that actually questions of kind of decency, human decency, come into play in what Facebook actually do, you know.
Mark, and then I guess sorry, can I just ask you there?
Yeah.
In relation to Facebook and Twitter, we'll run the two of them in together because like both are fairly well, the two biggest probably means of worldwide communication we have at the moment. Is there a propensity to appeal to the lowest common denominator? And again, I'm particularly thinking of some of the messaging by Trump, and I mean some of what he puts out there. Like, to believe it and to act on it, you would probably want to be pretty well in that category of the lowest common denominator. I mean, you'd nearly want to be brain dead. But the other side of it then is that until such time as governments levy and ensure they collect massive monetary fines, as in hurt these organisations in the pocket, you won't see a change.
Yeah, I think that question of like hurting in the pocket definitely comes into play. And we know, for example, that, like, you know, so we have Facebook, Twitter, Google, they're all present here, not just as like organisations in Ireland. They're outside US headquarters. World headquarters are based in Ireland. And that's primarily because of a very favourable kind of tax regime, which some people would say, you know, has been pointed out that actually that the way that our tax regime is set up facilitates kind of even greater kind of accumulation of wealth. So that would suggest that Ireland actually has a very particular role that it could play in terms of exerting kind of leverage on the organisations themselves. I mean, I think the question of like how Trump speaks online, for example, is a little beyond perhaps sort of our choice in terms of getting involved with the campaign. But I think there's a methodology to the madness there, and you know, one way of looking at it is it appeal to a lowest common denominator. Another way is that it appeals to a very particular type of politics, which is the politics of white supremacism, which is a politics of ever greater diversity, or you know, division. And actually lacks any kind of real social vision for what a democracy of kind of care is based upon, to tackle, you know, deep structural problems of inequality and injustice that overlap and intersect with stuff like race, but also kind of wealth accumulation, you know. And so I think there's the nature perhaps of the platform and the way that it gets used kind of makes for very snappy soundbite without dealing with the genuine complexity of human behaviour and human life and our societies. And I think, you know, there's one way is to frame it as the kind of lowest common denominator. Another way is perhaps looking at it from a marketing strategy. It's like the use of really simplistic messaging that actually is a way of avoiding dealing with you know, the really big problems that we face in society. And I think, like, that Trump is perhaps a caricature of himself in some ways. And while, you know, and particularly, like, on Facebook or Twitter, like, you know, he's a big catch. Those organizations are quite reluctant to kind of remove some of that content. However, if some of us had been, you know, anybody else had been pushing some of that stuff out, you know, calling for kind of violence, I guess, people against, you know, anti-racist activists and stuff like that, you know, you would have been taken off the platform or certainly banned. But, so I think it's all beholden. Like, there's space for us all to kind of think about how we use those platforms. I think there's a space for organisations in Ireland to think about how you're facilitating those organisations by spending money on the platforms, you know. And I guess that's the rationale for the support in this campaign.
And I fully agree with you, because at the end of the day, it's your money that's going into their coffers to boost their already accumulated billions of dollars in their case, because most of them are American-based companies. Mark, last question, which I'm thinking that every man on the street listening to this morning, and indeed woman on the street listening to this morning, will be asking and scratching their head. All these organisations are supposed to have moderators watching what's going on, because, I mean, we have seen, as you, and it's a phrase you've used there on numerous occasions, the radicalisation of people on social media. Now, radicalisation in any form, in any format, is not good. So you would imagine that there would be moderators there watching the content and vetting it before it goes up. But are they playing any role at all here, or are they being given an instruction to turn a blind eye to everything that's going up?
I don't think there's an instruction to turn a blind eye. I mean, I know there's actually been quite a significant amount of work done on terms of the types of monitoring that happens on different kind of platforms, you know. Facebook have a very bleak kind of history, I guess, in terms of, like, it farms out a lot of content moderation. So you end up, and have looked after workers really badly, I guess, in that regard. So very often people that are doing the monitoring of the most heinous of stuff that happens on the platform, and that includes child abuse, that includes murder, includes kind of violence, really kind of dark kind of things. People are watching those videos, making calls in them, and maybe have to go through, you know, 100 items a day. This has all kind of been documented by whistleblowers who work within Facebook, and sometimes those are in, you know, that's happened in kind of essentially warehouse kind of call centres in the US, but it's also happened in the Philippines and elsewhere. So it's very clear there's also the reliance, I guess, on artificial intelligence. So Facebook made a lot of noise around the fact that after the mass shooting of Muslim communities in two mosques in New Zealand a year or two ago, that they were using artificial intelligence as a way of kind of pulling the, you know, the uploads of the video. But it's just really weak in this regard, and it doesn't stand up. There's, you know, there's no credibility, I guess, in the idea that an organisation that accumulates multiple billions a year doesn't have the resource to fund, to look after staff, and to make sure staff are protected in you know, actually what is really grim work. Like, there's no credibility in the argument that the company can't do that. The company can do that, but it's just, you know, that would mean that actually there's less profit to be made. And I think that's the central thesis, I guess, of what the argument is about today, is like that actually that profit is being put forward, both in terms of, like, the social impacts that is happening, even on its own workers, as well as in kind of society in generally, you know. So, yeah, I probably repeat myself, but I don't think there's any plausibility in the sense that it can't monitor stuff. It's a question of a political and social choice by the leadership of the organisation, and that's one that we would hope, you know, happens sooner rather than later.
Mark, for people who are interested in joining or helping the organisation, how can they do it?
If you check out the website, colamh.org, it's colamh.org, and there's a menu at the top. You can kind of read about the work that we do, and also if you're interested in kind of joining or supporting or donating or anything like that, we're more than welcome to help.
Mark Malone from Stop Hate for Profit. Mark, thank you so much for joining me this morning. I really, really enjoyed our chat. I was so looking forward to it all week. Mark, thanks a million. It has been
a
pleasure.
Cheers, now. All the best.
Bye-bye.